Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel discussion. Welcome to a Tuesday morning, the 16th of December. It's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you all here. I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great privilege and honor to be able to broadcast to you and to talk about the important issues of the day, especially with such an amazing and learned panel. We welcome you to be a part of the discussion. All you have to do to join us is go write us a note at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll take it from there. Yesterday was we talked about a lot of violence and death yesterday. It was very hard show. We're going to have to pick up some of those stories today. But we'll try to do the best we can in keeping, some semblance of, we're going to try to keep you from not wanting to just sob. Yeah. I think that's all we're really trying to do. And I went through that last night or yesterday morning. And then last night, I just shout out to my wife. My wife is just the most loving, beautiful, incredible person that is on this planet. We're going to be away for the holidays, and so we're celebrating, doing sort of the Hanukkah thing and celebrating the days leading up to when we leave, and each night giving each other a gift. Well, last night my wife gave me the most incredible gift that I could have ever received. And I know this is going to sound like a joke, but honest to God, this happened, and it's just beautiful gesture. She paid all of my Albany speeding tickets. Ooh, how amazing is that?
That's true love.
She took the stack of paperwork, the voluminous stack. Now, for those of you outside of the city of Albany, a while ago they put in some of these speed cameras, And I'm not going to get into the politics of this. I just want to tell you that I trust any system that when they send you the notice, there are three references to the law pleading with you and to tell you that this is indeed legal, what they're doing. So you do have to wonder, but they quote it a lot. So they put up these cameras. So if you go by... And I was looking through the stack last night just to get the full meaning of the gift. And, in some cases I was doing a rollicking 22 and a 20 or a 31 and a 30, just breaking the law like a drunken sailor. And so my wife is and each one, by the way, there's not an easy way of doing this. You don't just go on and put in your license plate number and pay all of your tickets. No, that's too easy. Each one has a citation number,
right,
with a lot of periods in it. For some reason, I don't know. It's like 022 period 3567 period. And if you screw up the period, you're screwed. You're not gonna get in. So. And then they tell you pay it, and then if you got it before the first round, it's $50, and if you get it the second round, it's $75. I got the nicest $720 present that I've ever received in my life. Isn't that nice? I am a free man from the city of Albany until at least tomorrow afternoon.
You'll end the year in the black.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
with the city, I mean.
Yeah. Yes, with the city. That's right. That's right. And you can't wrap that kind of love. You really can't.
Hanukkah at the Donahue's.
It's just the nicest thing, and I'm so pleased and happy. To all of the people in the corporation that will receive the bulk of that money, happy holidays to all of you. Yes. Good luck to you.
Taxes will not go up as much this year in the city of Albany.
No, it's just great. It's one of those things too where I know where the camera is. Yeah. And I'm looking, I'm going slow, I'm going slow, I'm going slow, I'm going slow, boom. You see the flash go off, and you know, oh, all right, there's another $50. Well, yeah. Anyway, love Kelly, and thank you very much. And tomorrow she'll get me out of my DWI. No, just kidding. All right. Let me introduce everybody to the show. Malia Dumondis here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you. Jay Jochnowitz joins us, editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union newspaper. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I am well. I am. I have a clean record now. I've paid up all mine. You know, it is. My wife and I have a joke because the Altamont police are very determined to balance the budget there. And so our joke has always been, and people arriving at our house would invariably say they were coming up the hill. We live in just over the line in Knox, but they would come up the hill. It's hard to speed up a hill, but they would get you. And they would inevitably say, first thing, got a ticket coming up your hill. So our joke whenever we leave the house, and it's only a half a joke, is drive safe, don't speed through Altamont. And we say it every time to every kid, no matter where they're going, no matter which direction. If they came to visit, don't speed through Altamont. Guests and so forth. The other thing that I say, if I know my wife is going to Albany, I say, drive safe, don't speed through Altamont or Albany.
Yeah, right. And it's hard. I will say that if maybe in calendar year 2026, I'm thinking of doing this, because so many panelists have sent me copies of their tickets in outrage of saying to get at the show on time, they went a mile or and a half over the speed limit and they've received a ticket. I think we're going to start a GoFundMe page just to pay off all of those tickets for our panelists. Because, I mean, we don't pay you all, and you know, but it's very nice.
We did time this as an editorial board. I was joking. I wasn't the one who wrote the editorial, but I said to the editorial writer, you know, you ought to go to a school zone and clock how long it takes to drive through that school zone at 30 miles an hour and clock do this not on school hours, and then clock it at 25 miles an hour, because I think that's it's
20 or 25.
Clock it at 20. Clock it at 20. Yeah. We came up with, it was like 5 seconds, 15 seconds or something like that, and we said, you know, it really is not that much of your life to avoid this, but it does feel like a crapshoot.
Well, it also, and I agree with you. Although I feel like I've looked down and I'm doing like 18.
Yep.
But then they're I'm not saying their calculations are wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're right, but I'm not saying they're wrong. I just don't know. I have no idea. I don't know whose is right. I have no idea. J.P. Miller is here, the Empire Report's very own. And good morning, sir. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm great. I just fished one out of my mail the other day. But I got it before my wife saw the letter from the Albany Police Department.
That's what I got to figure out.
That's a bonus.
Yes.
A big bonus. So you get that and you say, this is great. I've got this. I'm going to go pay into the shredder and no one's the wiser.
Yeah, that's a good way of doing it. I got to get home earlier. My wife works at home, so that's the problem. Mike Spain is with us, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm very happy to be here. And so far, no tickets today.
No, but you don't, you know.
The day is young.
That's right. The day is young. I called up and I said, I went to the person because, as I said, you don't know. And I said, do I have anything outstanding? And she said, well, not as of right now.
Have you gone to work yet?
They've profiled you, Joe.
That's right.
Well, it was a good show today, Joe.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you.
This
very
great.
Very nice. Oh, goodness gracious. We have so much to discuss, and it's just, it's you know, it's awful, and we'll do what we need to do here. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay. Let's get to the news of the moment. I'm trying to find the actual. Did someone write me? I'll be right with you, folks. I'm just trying to get the topics There we go. I got it. Okay. I want to continue to talk about Brown University and the search that continues. Last night, as I was coming home, there was a press conference that took place, and this is after the day. So for those of you who are following this or who aren't following this, there was a tragic shooting on the campus of Brown University on Saturday during a session, tutoring session for an exam. And two people killed, nine others were injured on campus. They went then, of course, the manhunt goes for the person responsible for the shooting. They put out a very brief, dark, difficult to see anything of note video. And then the next day they said they have a person of interest that they have taken in, and that then information comes out. And I would like to ask the journalists about this, because I think this is really something that's fascinating. But the information starts to come out about this individual, the name of the individual, the LinkedIn page of the individual, all of this stuff of who went out and apparently was being accused, or possibly a person of interest in this crime. Turns out about 11 o'clock on Sunday night, they say, well, the evidence has taken us in another direction. So they let the person go. They let that person go. And then basically they're then starting from scratch. Yesterday, they spent the entire day again looking for information. So about 5-6 o'clock last night, they have a press conference and they're showing information that they have come up with. And it's just a little bit, a few more videos that have been taken from Ring doorbells and security cameras around the neighborhood. And not a tremendous amount. The person is wearing a mask. We got the color of the coat. He seems to be of a stocky build. But they also added a $50,000 reward. And the FBI and Providence Police now say that goes on, the search goes on, and that it has doubled its security staffing because they want to keep everybody safe, but they wanted to make the point that there is no immediate threat to campus. That point came under fire yesterday because they said, well, you put in a lockdown because someone was on the loose, and then you lifted the lockdown when you found somebody, and then you let the person... And then you let the person go, and then you didn't put a lockdown again. And they said, well, we're reasonably sure they're safe. And they said, well,
what do we know that somebody can
walk into a room and do something else? And they said, well, we don't see a pattern. The pattern with this individual that we know nothing about. Right. Okay. So that's sort of where we are and where we have been. These new images have been released. They're out there, and they're captured both before the shooting and after the shooting, and just very, very close to where the shooting took place on the campus of Brown University. So now you have a community. Now, most people, the college, the university for its part, said, okay, we're done. We're going to send the kids home. And no more finals. We're done. We'll take care of we'll figure out all of this later. And off you go. So many people leaving yesterday. And so that's the situation where we are as of 9:30 this morning. And I don't know much more except that the search goes on. And if there is information and great strides have been made, that has not yet been released to the public.
So it sounds like a mess, and it is. You know, I think JP expressed it pretty well. It feels a little like the moment in Jaws when the mayor was saying the beaches are fine and they're safe and everything. And what basis are they saying this? And what strikes me as so weird about all this is that this is the most making this look okay is one of the easiest things in police work, I think. I mean, you know, we've watched this for years. They don't say a lot. They say that they're working on it. They assure the public they're working on it. If you need a lockdown, if you need people to be safe, you tell them that. You let the community know that you have an intelligent, well thought out, calm, professional approach to this. This is not hard to do. And they are messing it up. And I'm trying to figure out why. And I'm wondering if it's part of the tension between the FBI and the local police department.
Well, there are members of the police department who have spoken out and said that's exactly what the case is. There were two incidents prior to the apprehension of the first individual where they said, because the president immediately put out that they had caught the individual responsible. This is shortly after the shooting itself. And then they retracted that. And then a short time later, they said that there had been another gun incident that had taken place. And they ended up retracting that. And then on the third thing, of course, being the taking in of a person of interest and then releasing that person several hours later.
Right. And then the president blaming the local police department and saying the FBI is doing a great job, but it's the local police department. Anything that goes wrong is the local police department's fault. This is not a way to run an investigation. And I don't blame, obviously, the local police department for what the president says, but how can you make a mess out of something like this?
Everyone is my friend. But I was watching the press conference yesterday, and I was watching the governor, and I was watching the mayor, and this is PR advice from Joe. let the mayor keep talking, because the governor is not helping anything.
Yeah, you know, Jay, you make a good point that the job of law enforcement is to make. You know, do everything you can to advise the public about what the status is, honestly. Right. And often in these cases, they'll say, we're working on it. I think in other high-profile shootings like this, where they've been zeroing in on suspects, they just say, we're making progress. And usually they are, and suddenly they've arrested somebody, you know. Maybe, you know, 100 miles away, or maybe, you know, longer or closer. But you do get the impression there's certainly not good communication. And maybe that's because there is not good coordination. There seems to be, when these big national events happen, you know, that get national attention, the FBI likes to announce it. The White House likes to announce that we have a suspect.
Right.
They like to be the first one to say it. And in this case, I think
it's very Andrew Cuomo-esque.
Yeah. Well, you know, in all fairness, it's very politician-esque. You know, politicians love to make the announcement. I mean, all I can think of is Al Haig. I'm in control here.
Right, yes.
You know, and I mean, they all want to assure you.
By the way, that was a frighteningly accurate impression of Al Haig.
But the, everybody wants to get up and they want to look good and they want to. The guy who did the good job, and I cannot think of his name, was after the shooting of in Utah of Charlie Crist. Is it Charlie? Why did I say the wrong
Charlie Kirk.
Name? Kirk, that's what I meant. Charlie Kirk. And the governor of Utah, I thought, was the most reasonable sounding and fair, you know, presenting the facts to calm people down. But everybody wants
Spencer Cox.
Right. Spencer Cox and a Republican. And, you know, you want to get up and you want to say something that's going to make people calm and you want to look good. And there's a contradiction between the facts and being able to look good sometimes. And in this particular case, it does certainly, if they are on to more than they're saying, and they may well be, and I hope they are, and they know reasons why you shouldn't worry, they should say so, because they have lost their credibility, and it's, I think, pretty scary. And if I lived across the street from the Brown campus, I'd be pretty frightened.
Yeah. JP?
Yeah, I agree with what Mike and Jay said. You know, there is someone, when you look at the pictures, there is someone out there who knows who this individual is. You can tell from the pictures, even though he's wearing a mask, you can see the features of his face. There are people out there who know who it is. I think a $50,000 reward is way light for someone who has shot 9 or 10 people randomly and is now walking around wherever he's walking around. I'm surprised that at this point that the Providence Police Department is still leading the investigation and not having more resources from the FBI. I think it's terrifying, and I think the reward should be a lot bigger. And I do understand the fact that they may not want to give out the individual's name because they don't want the individual to know that they are on to them. And I'm thinking back to a little bit the Luigi Mangione manhunt, where they knew a lot more about him than they were telling the media, but they were hot on his trail. And once they got him, then they released a bunch more information. So that is certainly a possibility here. But each 12-hour cycle that goes by that you don't have this guy that shot 9 or 10 people, it's a huge concern for everybody.
Malia, the college, university perspective of something like this?
Yeah, well, first of all, my thoughts really go out to all my colleagues at Brown. What a terrible tragedy for them to be managing. And I know they sent students home and just a tragic way to end the semester. And some students, and this is true at any college campus, don't have a home that's easy to get to other than their dorm room at the university. And so I'm sure there are many people. I mean, the campus is not empty, even though the semester has ended and they've sent the majority of students home. There's still a lot of people there, and Brown is their home, and it's been violated. I think what we've been talking about, the difficulties of communication, just underscores the fact that when the federal government gets involved, it makes coordination. I mean, there are resources, there are important resources that are brought, but coordination and communication is exponentially more difficult when you're adding that other layer in. And so it's disappointing, but not necessarily surprising that the communication has been muddied. Brown is not a small school. They have, I think, about 8,000 students. Mm-hmm. They have their own police force, which not a lot of, I mean, some larger universities, especially in, you know, urban areas, have their own police forces, which means they have, you know, armed members of the police who are employees of the university, safeguarding the place. It's in the middle of an urban area and is an open campus. I mean, there are some college and university campuses in the United States that have the ability to shut a gate and they're all in there and they can sort of shut themselves down and not be open. But I think most college campuses are not like that for a number of reasons. I mean, it's just logistically incredibly difficult, but also that's antithetical to what education is, closing doors and making it hard for people to get in. And so Brown is a center of intellectual and cultural life in Providence. And that's a description that it can apply to many colleges and universities across this country, that they welcome members of the community in. And so I know some people think, well, you got to make things safer. You got to close things down. If you make a university impossible to get into, then you effectively, you're shutting down the university. You're not just shutting the doors to make it safer. You're making it impossible for that institution to continue with its mission. So it's a difficult thing, but I can say, and the data backs this up, that college and university campuses in the United States are generally very safe places. Even taking into account this terrible tragedy at Brown. And there is a lot of information available about it because there is a law, the Clery Act, And all university and college campuses are required to report in on an annual basis in a number of different crime statistic categories, and that information is publicly available. So any member of the public can look up and see what different kinds of crimes have occurred somewhere, and they'll find that in many cases the college campus is safer than the area surrounding it. So I just encourage people not to advocate for measures that will do more harm than good in responding to this tragedy.
I want to ask, as I mentioned, two journalistic questions. Although, please, everyone, jump in. But I was taken. There was a moment at the press conference last night where an individual, and I believe it was the Attorney General of the state of Rhode Island, was responding. And there was a question from the media that came in. The TA, the person who was teaching the lecture course, the study course, when the event happened, spoke to the press and said that the person came in and said something and it was unintelligible. They couldn't figure out what the person was saying. They were wearing a mask. It was in the back of the room. And they didn't know what that was, what was said. And the person who was there, the TA, said that to the press. The Attorney General seemed to get upset by that, saying that they've been very displeased hearing these stories gain traction when there's no proof and they don't know what's going on. And I just thought to myself, okay, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But what I do know is I would think you would trust someone who was in the room. Like, if you have an eyewitness, yeah. And by the way, you've spent the last half hour of your press conference saying, please, if you know anything, if you've seen anything, please come to us, to then say that there was some sort of political politicization of the event because of those remarks. I was struck by that as something that was a bit odd, and I don't know exactly how it fits into the full narrative.
I don't either. It's an odd response. You're exactly right. That if you have an eyewitness who tells you something, unless you have some extraordinary reason to believe that if you report something, it's going to screw up an investigation, and maybe it would be wise not to do. I can't even imagine the circumstances, but
yeah, I mean,
wouldn't you?
The first thing that reporters would do, what a journalist would do, is try to find out everything they can, talk to as many people as they can. I'm sure somebody tried to talk to this teaching assistant who was running the class prior to the press conference yesterday. I don't know if that was successful or not. But the idea is you find out everything you can, and then you report with attribution and with, the necessary disclosures. One person said they saw this, however, they were 100 yards away. I mean, you try to factually put into context the information you're getting. And when they announce they have a person of interest, like they did within hours after it on Sunday, it's perfectly reasonable to report that. And all you can do is when an awful tragedy happens or any news event happens, you talk to as many people as you can. And it seems, doesn't it seem like there's something going on behind the scenes? They know something and they're just not saying it. And they're it just has that feel. I don't know. As JP said, the Mangione case where they were following him and they did have a lot of information about him that they did not disclose because it's very useful in tracking the person down before they're aware that they're, been identified. And maybe that's the case here. But boy, they're botching this. They're leaving everybody that apparently unsure and uncertain. And it's really a good example of a badly communicated event.
It also reminds me of when the Charlie Kirk assassination happened, that Kash Patel, the FBI director, went out to have a steak dinner at Rao's that night rather than flying out to Utah to help lead the investigation. And the FBI has priorities. Is this the FBI's top priority? Is it number 17? Is it number 4? And so this should be, in my view, an investigation that's led by the FBI, and the FBI director should be there and show that this is his priority. I mean, right now it might seem safe in Providence, but we don't know how safe it is in Providence. There's a person who shot 10 people who's walking around, and, the FBI director was happy to take credit once they caught the wrong guy, and now it's...
It's their fault that they didn't catch him.
Yeah. So this is, this is number two, at least by my count, in terms of these kind of shootings, the second one where the FBI director is, in my view, not leading the investigation or encouraging the FBI to lead the investigation. The FBI certainly has more weapons and more tools at their disposal than the local police.
The other journalistic question is the one of... How much do you report on a person who is a person of interest who's been taken in, the first individual? Within an hour, they had a LinkedIn page. They had the fact that he was from Wisconsin. They had the fact that he was expected to attend Brown University in the fall. A story was a narrative was being built on the fly for an individual of what you can obtain pretty easily online for someone who ended up not being, apparently, as of right now, not being a part of this at all. I don't think that'll ever stop, right?
I can't imagine it would. I mean, you do your best under the circumstance when the police appear to have person of interest. And 9 times out of 10, person of interest ends up being another word for suspect. So you have to treat it like that as a journalist. But you also have to, I think
he has not been charged.
This is a cautionary tale. You always add that in. He has not. Yeah, exactly.
And there he's being held. But then the picture starts to emerge, and I think naturally we just start filling in the blanks. At one point last night, again, at the press conference, they were blaming the media. It was like, well, we never released the name. You were the ones who released the name. And I'm thinking, well, there's some way that they got the name, right?
Well, the journalists are also not competing, but somewhat competing with, when you're online, you see these online sleuths that are putting out all this information, and you don't know whether to trust it or not to trust it. And
I wonder if that's what this official was trying to warn against, this not necessarily the journalists who are following the story and doing the investigation, but some of the sort of the rumor mongering that happens around things that quickly escalates. Because there was just to bring the story from Australia into this, because that was happening around the yes. same time, and there are some similarities quickly rumors started percolating that the gunmen there were Afghan, and where that came from, I don't know, but that took hold. And so I can imagine that to the extent that officials in Rhode Island were able to pay attention to things that are happening elsewhere in the world, they saw that and thought, we don't want that happening here. And so I expect maybe what they were trying to convey is a little bit of a warning and a caution about not getting ahead of ourselves.
I think when we talk about filling in the blanks, the host of the Late Night on NBC, Seth Meyers, spoke at length yesterday at the beginning of his program about Robin Michelle Reiner. And one of the comments that he made that struck me was, he said, when I heard about this in light of what happened in Australia and given what I know about Rob Reiner, the first question I asked was, did this have anything to do with his politics? Mm-hmm. And two, did this have anything to do with him being Jewish? And he said, the fact that I ask those questions, like those were my immediate thoughts when I heard it, tells us a lot of where we are. And this was, of course, before we knew family members, a family member could have been involved. But that really struck me because it does, you know, I think there is a natural sort of you take the information in and you try to make sense of what is really hard to make sense of. And you start asking questions like that because, quite frankly, they're fair questions to ask and to pose. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Jay Jacknowitz, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain, Malia Dumont with us, and we thank you very much for being with us on this Tuesday morning. Two things I just wanted to mention that are eerie, but the shooting on Saturday came on the eve of the 13th anniversary of the Sandy Hook School massacre, to put that into some context. That claimed the life of 26 people, including 20 who were elementary students in kindergarten and first and second grade. Also, the other fact, and we mentioned this on the program yesterday, but at least two students at Brown had survived previous school shootings. Those who were impacted on that day, on Saturday, had one in Saugus School in California, the other in Parkland in Florida. And the fact, I mean, that I'm sorry, I find that more than a coincidence. That seems that it really does tell us of the regularity, mm-hmm. With which this happens and how it happened. And also the really of what's being the impact that this has on the students. And of how many, I watched an interesting story yesterday about students talking about, and obviously this is very real at the moment and in the moment, and you know what will happen in a few weeks or a few months is something different. But these were students who were saying, I don't even know if I want to come back. Like, I don't see myself walking into that building again. That's fair. Yeah. I mean, that's a fair thing. Like, that's, yes, I understand that completely. And these are all things to take into consideration as we talk about these stories over and over and over again.
I just think about, I mean, we're in the middle of recruiting season, right, for students who might enroll in any college and university for the fall 26 academic year. And, you know, even before this, I occasionally will go on recruiting trips, and I've done some of that overseas. And even before this tragedy at Brown, one of the top questions I would get, and most of the recruiting I've done has been in Asia, where, I mean, gun ownership by citizens is just pretty much unheard of. You know, like in Japan or China, it's just not possible. And so it's hard for people to wrap their minds around the idea that gun ownership is a right in the United States and that it's celebrated by many people. And so one of the top questions I would always get is, how safe will my child be? Which a lot of people in the United States don't think about that question because they're just so used to this. But people from around the world are looking and like, just think, like, those people are crazy. Why does this keep happening? And, you know, I can only answer in the context of Bard College and give them specifics about Bard, and it's in this, you know, this rural area, and that seems to help them understand that they're not taking some wild risk by contemplating sending their kid. And I'm sure, like, all the families who lost people at Brown didn't think they were taking some wild risk, and the young people who chose Brown didn't think they were taking some wild risk by going there. it's one of the other things this brings to mind to me is just linking back to some of my previous work in the Pentagon on counterterrorism is the difficulty of identifying and preventing what are often called lone wolf actions. And even though in Australia, Bondi Beach, it was two people, I would characterize it essentially as a lone wolf type action as
well.
Father
and son.
Father and son, yeah. And it's extremely difficult to prevent such things. And I think in a lot of these mass shootings in the United States, they fall into that category of a lone wolf. And unless you want to lock up everyone who fits a profile of being somewhat, you know, socially awkward, and you're going to cast an enormous net that would catch many, many people who are not violent.
I wouldn't be here.
Exactly. I mean, it's like you can't do that. It's really hard to pinpoint people in advance without really violating a lot of rights.
I just want to hit on one thing that you said about, you know, no one thought at Brown that they were taking a risk, but you could say, I mean, if it didn't happen at Brown, it could happen somewhere. I mean, it's anywhere. It's
right,
not
exactly.
It's not. It has nothing really to do with Brown as much as it is that this is the culture that brings us. It could happen anywhere at any time.
I mean, it wasn't likely some guy in Providence, Rhode Island, walking, you know, down the street and doing it. It's somebody who had some manifesto, some purpose, some axe to grind, some mental, anguish over something and wanting to take it out on people. I mean, yeah, it's not about Providence. It's probably not about Brown itself. We'll find out more, you know?
I do want to just give some context to what I was talking about earlier. The gentleman's name is Joseph Aduro. He is a 21-year-old teaching assistant and was holding his final review session of the year in room 166 of the building on the campus of Brown. The session ended just after 4 p.m., a little later than planned. Aduro, who helps teach economics to undergraduates, was delivering closing remarks to his class and watching his students stand up to leave when the sound of gunfire cut through the room. Then came the screams. Moments later, Aduro said the gunman entered the auditorium from the back of the room and locked eyes with him. He came in, he pointed the gun, and then screamed something. Aduro recalled that he just started shooting right after that. The first shots ripped into the chalkboard exactly where Aduro had been standing seconds earlier. One of his students was shot in the legs. Aduro and about 20 students ducked and huddled behind a desk in front of the auditorium, the only refuge available, and called 911. There wasn't much space behind the desk, Aduro said. He estimated it to be about 10 feet long. We made do, he said, because at the end of the day, we just all wanted to survive. It felt like an eternity before the gunfire stopped. He didn't lift his head until campus public safety officers entered the room and told him that it was safe to leave.
What a compelling story. Well presented. It puts the reader inside that room when that tragedy happened and helps them understand the drama of and the awfulness of it. And, you know, that is a part of journalism. It's to tell the story. And I think it was a completely appropriate story. You don't have to read it if you don't want to, but it was done very well.
And reporting done by CNN's Awa Alasser.
So. To Mike's point and to your, to your question about, in terms of journalism, people used to ask me, did you get into journalism because of Woodward and Bernstein or Watergate? And it was actually reading that kind of stuff in Newsday when there would be anything as, ordinary as a car accident or as extraordinary as a shooting. I remember, I could even tell you which side of the table I was sitting on reading, the kitchen table, I was sitting reading those stories. And I would think, my God, how do reporters do this? Well, you just go out and you ask questions and you find people who can tell the stories that you want, that people want to hear told. And that is so fundamental. And it fills a void and it fills it legitimately as opposed to, the rumor mill that a lot of, that too many people online practice is you're playing by certain rules, and you're also filling a void that the police will not usually fill and prosecutors won't fill. They're waiting for the trial to tell you, here's the motive, here's, you know, here's the scenario. We don't want to give out details of the crime because only the suspect knows those, and we don't want to give away things that he or she could say during an interrogation that would fully indict, you know, incriminate them. So there's all sorts of things the police don't want to tell the public. The journalists do tell the public, and the public wants to know.
Just the idea that we're talking, when we use terms like a teaching assistant, you know, this is a person who is in charge of that environment, who is leading that particular moment. Student, he's 21 years old, and that's a lot.
You know,
that's a lot, especially when these are your classmates who are also there and in that moment. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return. Ray Graff has the news. We'll go to him right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we welcome you into the discussion, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we have Jay Jochnowitz, JP Miller, Mike Spain, and Malia Dumont with us this morning on the panel. And we welcome you, as I mentioned. So I do want to talk just a moment about this was all unfolding yesterday as we were on the air of the arrest of Rob Reiner's son and for the murder that took place on Sunday afternoon, and also the president's comments, which we did talk about briefly because they came out as we were doing the show yesterday. I just thought we'd spend a moment talking about the reaction to it. In the decades since he announced his presidential campaign by branding immigrants as criminals and rapists, the accepted wisdom about Donald Trump has become this: no matter how outrageous are the things he says, he feels no consequences. With each offensive blast, Republican elected officials are rendered mute or tell inquiring journalists they haven't seen the latest and quickly excuse themselves. MAGA influencers applaud and celebrate the ire Trump generates from the left as, quote, owning the liberals. So what happened Monday was noteworthy, maybe a sign that there really is a limit to how low Trump can take the public discourse, maybe evidence that his powers are waning, or maybe nothing more than an anomaly and a disturbance in the force. There was an actual blowback from some on the right over the president's reaction to the stabbing death of Hollywood director Rob Reiner and his wife Michelle Singer Reiner, allegedly at the hands of their 32-year-old son, who had struggled for years with addiction and mental illness. As Trump is wont to do, he made it about himself. The president described the tragedy this way on the Truth social media platform that has become an outlet for his id. Rob Reiner, a tortured and struggling but once very talented movie actor and comedy star, has passed away together with his wife, Michelle, reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump Derangement Syndrome, all caps, sometimes referred to as TDS. Reiner, Trump wrote, was known to have driven people crazy, all caps, by his raging obsession of Donald J. Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness and with the golden age of America upon us. Feels like a golden age, doesn't it? And perhaps like never before, may Rob and Michelle rest in peace. The Washington Post piece goes on and says this was too much for a handful of conservative influencers who have large followings of their own, with one saying, what happened last night to Rob Reiner and his wife was a savage butchering of two human lives. I don't care what their politics were or how they felt about Trump. No law-abiding human deserves this. We should pray for and send condolences to his loved ones and not make it political, that according to Robbie Starbuck online. British broadcaster Piers Morgan, along longtime friend of Trump, wrote, "This is a dreadful thing to say about a man who just got murdered by his troubled son. Please delete it, Mr. President." And then Thomas Massie, as Mike mentioned earlier, Marjorie Taylor Greene and others speaking out. But man, not a lot. Right?
No, not
I
a
mean,
lot.
Not a lot.
No.
It quieted down quickly the few criticisms that were made by people who are ordinarily in the Trump camp. Yeah, I mean, he got criticized outside of that, of course, and you know, many people did it. This whole notion of Trump derangement syndrome, I think it's an invention that the mega people came up with so they can, you know, they need slogans, they need terms, and they sort of created this phenomenon that they say exists. If you are upset by the things that Trump does, you obviously are mentally distraught and suffering from a identifiable trauma, and it's your fault, and there's nothing wrong with Trump. I mean, it's absurd. It sounds like it's an extension of the whataboutism we got used to. Like every time something would happen, Trump would be accused of something. Well, Bill Clinton did that, you know, or a Democrat did that, or Joe Biden did that, you know, I mean, or Hillary Clinton did that. It just is a deflection tool that they're trying to use. And I think there is a Trump derangement syndrome, and I think I know who's suffering from it.
Yes. Yeah, it certainly seems that way. A little fact that I learned yesterday that I didn't know, but Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, that was the bestseller that really that propelled him even more so, the picture on the front cover of that book was taken by Michelle Reiner. And so
wow.
There's that connection, too, which was, I thought, interesting. A professional photographer, of course, and done a long time ago in the 80s, but still something that was an interesting crossover. The president made no mention of that in his comments yesterday. House Speaker Mike Johnson told reporters on Monday, in the holiday season, we have to appeal to our better angels, and I think we've got to amplify those voices and those sentiments. Then he hastened down a private hallway to his back door into his office.
Of course he did. Of course he did. You know, this is going to last. Well, I would have said it would last as long as it takes for somebody to ask it in a news conference to Carolyn Leavitt and for Carolyn Leavitt to give the most ridiculous response. You know, something like, you know, this just shows the president's sensitivity toward grieving families. And his determination to be the consoler in chief of the nation. I mean, it's going to be something that ridiculous. Or she's just going to say, well, look, you know, the president says what he says, and we all, you know, and 78 million or 80 million people voted for him because of that. And you know, it's going to be something like that. And this is, to use the phrase they used in the piece, a disturbance in the force that a few Republicans, a few conservative commentators. Have said even more forcefully than usual, oh, tisk tisk, harumph. And that's it. And we're going to go back. We got three more years of this guy. they're not going to throw him overboard.
But I kept coming back to this last night in my brain, which was, well, who cares?
It's
awful, but we're not expecting any great oratory on you know, speaking to our better angels at this point. It's going to be garbage that comes out. We can't expect anything else. And I said this yesterday when I read the post for the first time. It's like, I hate talking about this. I do think it's good for people to hear what is being said to see how low we can go. But difference.
I hate talking about it too. And honestly, if this is the kind of conversation that might come up around the dinner table at with my family around, you know, Christmas time or whatever, and that I would try to shut it down because I want to dispute something that was said that the president made this about himself. He didn't make it about himself. He tried to make it about himself. It is not about him. There, besides this picture that you just brought up, there is zero connection or relevance from anyone in D.C. to this terrible murder of Rob Reiner and his wife. And it looks like their own son did. Like, there is nothing, no connection there And so I'd rather not indulge a narcissist's interest in trying to make it about him by talking about it more, because it literally had, as you point out, like very little impact. I mean, some Republicans said a few things and then they've scurried off. But it's really like the story is about Rob Reiner and his wife and a terrible story of addiction. Even if, I mean, we don't know if the son did it or not, but even if he didn't, like there's still there's a really heartbreaking family story there that a lot of Americans can relate to.
But with that bully pulpit,
yeah,
there could have been a time to say, you know, we pray for the family and we pray for all of those who are dealing with addiction and
right.
and
and since he didn't say that, which I did not expect him to say, I'm like, okay, you again did not take the stance of what I would call a decent leader, and so I'm not interested in the indecent things that come out. And so, I mean, there are things that have to be opposed, obviously, and I do my utmost to try to oppose the things that are hurting people. And then the spouting off on irrelevant topics, I also try to minimize its presence and impact in my life, because I feel like we give so much airtime to this person on every subject that has nothing to do with him. And now here I am going on and on.
No, I do think it's important to talk about, because it is a low point, and if you don't mention it, and then it just sort of goes away. But by the same token, I was watching Jake Tapper last night, and he had on the actor Kevin Pollak. Kevin Pollak starred in A Few Good Men with Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson, a movie that was directed by Rob Reiner. And Kevin Pollak, who is a great actor and also a very, very funny man and a very gifted impersonator, just does great impressions. I mean, his Nicholson is great. Anyway, so he was talking to Jake Tapper yesterday, and Jake Tapper asked him about the comments. And he said, well, the way that all of us are looking at it is, by saying that, he proves everything that Rob Reiner has said about Trump over the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that he's bottom of the barrel. He doesn't, you know, that it's not, he does not, he's not a leader. He shouldn't be president. And everything that just in that statement goes to prove what he had said about him time and time again.
Somebody had commented on my post. They just quoted, they put on a Rob Reiner, a series of quotes from him. And I think it was to somehow do exactly what Trump was doing, you know, somehow justify this, to say, look what terrible things he said about the president. To the credit of the people who were on my thread, they did not engage this person. They thanked him for exactly that, for pointing out exactly how right Rob Reiner was about the president of the United States, about right. Donald Trump. I thought it was great. I think to Malia's point, you're right. He's always going to go low when he has the chance to do so, and he's always going to make this about himself, that he has to be at the center of every news cycle. What drives me to this is not as a journalist, but as a human being, that I am forever amazed and ever wondering, is it possible that people will defend this? How it's my fellow human beings.
Kind of like a sociological observation.
Just as a human being, that's what really frustrates me about this. It's not that Donald Trump says these things; it's that people listen to it and they fit it into a narrative that works for them. The way we were talking on the break about how a particular talk radio person was giving a full-throated defense of Trump for why this was perfectly okay, not only okay, but exactly what Trump needed to do. And it was like, how could you do this? I know this person. I run into this person in the gym. I know this person from years ago. He's not this insane. And yet, for whatever reason, he is defending absolutely indefensible. This was just cruelty.
It was cruelty.
I think this statement was actually a pretty big deal from the president. I think that it is going to negatively impact his standing with moderates and Republicans. And it's because Rob Reiner is a unique cultural icon in America. You know, back in the 70s, when All in the Family was on, it wasn't just Democrats or watching All in the Family. All of America watched All in the Family. Republicans, Democrats, everybody loves All in the Family. And in the 90s, everybody in the country watched Seinfeld every Thursday night and talked about it Friday morning. And there aren't shows like that anymore that literally shape our culture, like All in the Family, like Seinfeld, like the movie Misery, like the movie Stand By Me. And there aren't Goliaths of the entertainment industry like Rob Reiner anymore. And Trump did this to get himself in the news cycle, and he succeeded. But I think it's going to hurt him. I think it's going to hurt him in the midterms. And he's picking a fight with a dead man who, in clip after clip after clip of seeing Rob Reiner talk about just a genuine nice guy his entire life, his words about the Charlie Kirk murder, where he says, "I don't care what your politics are, no one deserves to die that way." We are going to see over the coming 3 to 4 to 5 days through his funeral, there is going to be an outpouring of mourning for this guy, because there just aren't human beings like him anymore, and human beings that so deeply affect our culture as Rob Reiner has over the last 4 decades.
Oh, I still want you to be right. I really do.
Yeah, I hope you're right too. I mean, I think there'll certainly be parts of it, and there'll be a swath of it. I don't know. I hope it doesn't take on what Jay was saying of that the fact that one or two people come out and then it starts to pick up steam and more people start to defend what was said, and that it's minimized in some way, shape, or form.
I like JP's narrative. I'm going with that.
Yeah, let's go with that.
I'm taking that away from this today and making myself.
Yeah, and happy. To Malia's point, it's just this is a murder, of what allegedly is the son, who has been troubled for more than half of his life, since I believe 15 years old.
He was in rehab at age 15.
Yeah,
And you know, Rob Reiner, with all his success in Hollywood, he had the resources. He could pay for the finest rehab. He could get the best psychologists, the best doctors, and it's not enough. Yeah. It's just not enough.
I was listening to some of the tape that came out of they made a movie. Rob Reiner and his son made a movie about 10 years ago, having to deal with that the son wrote in regards to a character's dealing with addiction issues.
Autobiographic.
Yes, autobiographical. And Rob Reiner directed the film. And in one of the things that Rob Reiner said is that, you know, what I realized is that I was listening to doctors and I wasn't listening to my son. Mm. And it just really struck me because, I mean,
that self-awareness and the honesty of that is just powerful.
Yeah, but it goes to another level too of you parents and people who blame themselves for what is responsible for what their kids do, and had they done something different, would it have made a difference? I mean, addiction is awful. Who knows what it would have. What would have happened? My nephew, my brother's son, after I think a 12-year battle with heroin addiction, OD'd, and then the guilt that my brother felt, but then also, what more could that family have done? You know, what more? And you talk about the means, absolutely. And I know my brother and his wife were doing whatever they could to help that kid, And it's not enough. But instead of talking about those issues, instead of talking about what we can do as a society and what we can do, I mean, so many levels to it, of keeping the drugs off the streets, of mental health and care, providing resources for families who aren't billionaires or millionaires, is a really big thing. But it just loses complete sight of, and I don't even I heard last night of them referring to the son as a murderer, and I mean I know that's accurate, but a very troubled young man who was not aware at all of what was going on in that body of his.
And there's going to be a lot of people out there. You know, you just think of how many, it's not hundreds of thousands, it's millions of people who in one way or another know exactly what you're talking about. They they're either friends with a family or they're family members or they have been touched in some way by this, the opioid epidemic.
Everybody. Yeah. Everybody.
And everybody's going to look at that. And now this only deepens that story, and they're going to say, "Boy, you smack people when they're down. I mean, they're dead."
Well, and then you're going to give me a load of crap about how you're stopping drugs from coming into the country by bombing boats.
And if he had just shut up, as you said, for 5 minutes, he could have actually said something not necessarily true, but more, you know, self-serving to his agenda, and said, "This is why we need to keep drugs out of the country."
That's right.
Even the liberals, and maybe liberals will start seeing the wisdom of what I do. I mean, I don't know what he would have said, but
he didn't. That'll come out.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a half hour left. We'll talk about other stuff. Welcome to our pick-me-up edition of the Roundtable, and we'll discuss other stuff. See where we can go. We welcome your letters as always, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll get to as many of your letters as we possibly can over the remaining moments after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. Hold on. Yeah, I only cough when I laugh. All right. So we have a couple of notes here. I would like to read those, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Dear panel, it wasn't that long ago the right clutched their pearls when the left pointed out disgusting things Charlie Kirk had said. School teachers lost their jobs over truthful statements about Kirk. The right went on to say the left was behind political violence. Please don't shrug off Trump's disgusting statements about a murdered man. I think that's a fair point. Mm-hmm. That's from Craig, and I think it's a fair point because it is. I don't think it should be shrugged off because it does show, what's going on. Also, if any positive outcome should come out of the Reiner family tragedy, might it be a reexamination and reform of mental health services and ways for families to have a voice in committing loved ones to humane psychiatric hospitals? And Marion said, there are two stories here, both of which need to be addressed separately. Trump's comments are a story in itself. It's important to show the country his progressive decline. He is a malignant narcissist with dementia. Both conditions get worse. We ignore that at our peril. We cannot normalize this, and we also cannot grow numb. It's the growing numb part that's hard, I find, because I do feel a numbness. Because being numb doesn't allow you to fully get yourself all worked up.
Over something you can't really do anything about.
Control.
And I think that's why,
you don't expect anymore. You can't expect anything
Maybe that's why I have less patience for this discussion, because I'm already so activated in so many other areas where I'm trying to stand up against the assaults on higher education and on international students and everything. I'm like, I don't want to say I'm tapped out, because I'm sure there will be something else that will come up that I will need to stand up against. But on the list of priorities that I've been dealing with, like, and I agree with the notes that have just come in, but it's just I'm like, I can't take care of this one. I'm doing all the other things. And so I think it is a danger. We have bandwidth issues. It affects all of us in different ways. But that's not to say that it's not disgusting what was said.
Fox News has explained to its listeners that Trump derangement syndrome is real, writes Dave. This is why this nightmare is just going to keep going and going. Laura writes to us and says, allegedly the Venezuelan boats are carrying cocaine. That is not the drug that is disabling and killing Americans. It's the opioids, and we constantly give the Sackler family a pass. They get out of criminal charges by twisting bankruptcy laws. Also, alcohol kills more people every year than illegal drugs. My sister died at 46. I was caring for a friend in end-stage liver cancer this fall. He passed away in November. I can think of at least four other friends and coworkers' brothers. My former minister's brother died in his 40s last year from alcohol. They had all tried hard by going to rehab, etc., but the alcohol got a hold and wouldn't let it go. I feel for the Reiner family and all others dealing with addiction, and Laura, we feel for you as well. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. All right, let's move on to other topics. I do want to mention the aftermath of the deadly Bondi shooting in Australia and talk a little bit. We can get into the gun aspect of this, but just the overall aftermath of the event. The Prime Minister vowed on Monday to toughen Australia's already strict gun laws after the country's worst mass shooting in three decades killed 15 people and wounded dozens more at a Jewish holiday celebration in Sydney. He said at a news conference, the government is prepared to take whatever action is necessary. Officials have said that the attack on Sunday at Bondi Beach was an act of terrorism carried out by a 24-year-old Australian citizen and his father, an immigrant living in the country legally. The elder man, who is 50 years old, who came to the country in 1998, had six firearms registered in his name. His country of origin was not immediately clear. Police officers responding to the massacre shot both suspects, killing the father and wounding the son. They have not publicly identified either man. The police said on Monday that they expected to bring criminal charges against the young man. Australia had what advocates consider the gold standard on gun control. The country essentially banned assault rifles and many other semi-automatic weapons, as well as shotguns, after a gunman killed 35 people in Port Arthur in 1996. After the attack at Bondi Beach, the country's leaders said they were prepared to enact additional restrictions.
I think there was a news report that came out this morning that that the father was identified as being from India, like he was a citizen of India. Yeah. So this attack doesn't mean that Australia doesn't have the gold standard and gun control. I expect that. I mean, during this same period, since they've enacted these very strict gun control laws, we can just look at the statistics comparing the United States with Australia. I mean, how many attacks did we have and they didn't? So clearly, it's been a successful deterrent in many cases, and this is the very sad exception that shows it's extremely difficult to stop. Again, to get back to what I mentioned before, lone wolf terrorism. And it seems like that from the news reports we're seeing that the father and son visited southern Philippines, where there are active terrorist groups, offshoots of ISIS, that they were going there. I expect we'll learn they were going there. They received some kind of training. They were inspired, but they didn't act at the orders of anyone. That's why, even though they were inspired by ISIS, they're still considered lone wolf. So nobody was directing them. There was no communication to intercept. That's why law enforcement didn't know. There was no chatter. You hear about, like, there's chatter that a terrorist attack might coming. There's no chatter in advance of a lone wolf attack. The proximity of Philippines to so many places across Southeast Asia that experience a lot of civil unrest. Although I wouldn't characterize Australia as a place experiencing a lot of civil unrest. One of the the statistics that I was interested to see. I didn't realize that a third of Australia's population was born outside the country. I mean, that's an extraordinarily high percentage of immigrants. And so I think that they've been very successful in integrating people from around the world, much more so than a lot of other countries that have had very generous open doors for people to come in and immigrate. So, of course, there's a move to strengthen their already strict laws. And I'm sure that this will also give some fodder to the Australian right, although the person we haven't mentioned is the hero who stopped the other gunman, who was an immigrant himself from Syria. It's a complicated story, and they don't have a constitution that enshrines the right to bear arms in Australia, and that's why it's easy for their prime minister to say we're going to look at what stricter laws we can put in place.
I believe they're already drawing up legislation to limit how many guns people can own and things like that that go beyond the reforms that came after the Tasmania attack back in 1996. I think where 35 people were killed, and it just became a time to just, you know, take back the guns in Australia. But they do not have a constitutional enshrinement, as you put it. Accurately, and it's not celebrated as a sacred right, and yet it's a country with, a great outback with a lot of wild areas where there's hunters and ranchers and a need to have access to firearms as part of the culture and part of the work to protect them. So I mean, it just tells you how difficult it is to balance the, the need to have access and the need to stop these awful things from happening. I mean, if you keep guns away from people, they're not going to shoot. Simple as that.
Yeah, I spoke to the Australian ambassador some years ago in a Q&A that a bunch of editorial types did when we were doing a conference down in Washington. And he was – it was interesting because he was a conservative guy. And he was a farmer or a rancher, and he was very matter of fact when I asked him about gun control there. It was like we were really on two different frequencies. You know, as an American asking the question about guns to a conservative Australian politician, I think I would have expected a more rousing defense of the right to bear arms. And he was so matter of fact about it. He said, you know, we made a decision as a country not to, you know, that we don't need this proliferation of guns. Works for me. And, granted, he's, speaking the company line as an ambassador, but I was surprised at how I didn't think he was pulling my leg or just repeating the company line. I was surprised that one person in Australia had six guns. That doesn't sound like maybe the gold standard of gun control, but it doesn't mean that their gun control is bad. It just means maybe that is one of the things they want to fine tune. When someone's collecting a lot of guns, I don't know. I have a number. Because they all serve a different purpose, depending on the size of the animal and the need for it to be chased off the farm or dealt with. But six, I don't need six calibers of weapons. I'm pretty sure of that.
JP?
I didn't think so much about the gun control. When I saw the story and read about it, I think more of the fact that there still is radical Islamic extremism in our country. Not in our country, in our world, and certainly in our country as well, but also that it's a small percentage of Muslims, and how better exemplified than it was a Muslim man named Ahmed El Ahmed that went and heroically tackled the attacker and caught on film for everybody to see. It's such a remarkable piece of footage and a remarkable reminder of those two facts of there is extremism. And it's not all Muslims, because a Muslim put his own life on the line to save a bunch of Jewish people by attacking you know,
a man with a rifle.
disarming that man with a rifle when that person did not have a rifle. I thought that was the most remarkable part of the story.
Yeah, you don't get an easy narrative politically out of that whole that whole thing at all.
No,
which is good. good being a very relative thing in this context.
If it had happened in the United States and it was people who had been in the Philippines, the president probably would have banned immigration from the Philippines right on the spot. I mean, it doesn't serve the problem at all. No.
And also with regards to the gun control issue, something that wasn't covered that much because of the Reiner incident, the Bondi incident, and the I'm losing
Brown.
Track.
Brown.
There were on late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, there were six teenagers shot in Brooklyn. None of them killed, but all between the ages of 15 and 17 years old at a house party. And you know, you can imagine, you know, me being 15 and 17, I went to a lot of house parties, and I was never worried about getting shot by guns. And six kids got shot, and because of those other news stories that we've been talking about, that didn't become a larger story, and luckily they all survived. But the gun issue, just especially being on the panel, it just never goes away. We're always...
It is amazing. I mean, Mike, you were on the editorial board, you know, around the early teens, 2008 on, really, after I joined the editorial board. Every time there was a mass shooting, I feel like we wrote about it.
Well,
a lot.
Sad to say, we've been on this program so many times the morning after a mass shooting. Mm-hmm. And what do you say?
Yeah.
I mean, you can say it again. You can say it more strongly, you know, and there's tidbits that make a lot of sense that come out of it. I don't mean to characterize it as a tidbit, but I think, JP, your point about a Syrian, you know, being the hero in this to stop these killers, to help stop these killers of the Jewish people in Australia, you know, it's a poignant part of it, and it does put in context that, you know, while some of these terrorists are Islamic extremists, that it does not represent the Islamic faith, and you know, I mean, gosh, there's so many examples of Christians, white Christians in the U.S. carrying off, you know, mass killings, and we don't say, oh, it's because they're white Christians. I mean, that's kind of obvious, but...
Well, then it's mental illness.
Yeah, it must be mental illness.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the program and finish up the panel portion of the program. We welcome you in the last moments, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back. Final moments of our panel, and we welcome you. We are going to end with a story that, as far as I know, does not include any bloodshed. So here we go. Governor, the latest poll, this is on your Empire Report page, JP, and Deck the Polls is what is the headline. Deck the Polls. And the latest Siena poll is out. Governor Kathy Hochul holds double-digit leads over both Representative Elise Stefanik. Hochul leads 49-30% with 20% undecided. And Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, 50-25% with 21% undecided, according to a new Siena poll of New York State registered voters released today. Voters support 65-27% universal free child care for infants through pre-K, paid for by increased taxes on New York taxpayers earning from $1 million. By a narrower 50-41%, New York City voters support eliminating bus fares, paid for by increased taxes on city taxpayers earning more than $1 million. And those are just some of the headlines coming out of this particular poll. But I would like to focus in on the numbers in regards to Kathy Hochul. The governor, the current governor, and the, I would say, the front runner in the Republican Party, Elise Stefanik, and those numbers and what we can make of those numbers as of the release of this poll December 16th.
I think it's obviously very good news for Governor Hochul, seeing her approval rating go above the magic 50% number. She's now at 52%, which is 4 points better than the last Siena poll that was taken. Also, since the last Siena poll, it was Hochul versus Stefanik. Stefanik, who was the presumptive Republican nominee until a few weeks ago when Bruce Blakeman entered the race, Bruce's entrance into the race now makes it people perceive it less likely that that a Republican may be able to take out Hochul because, you know, they have a history. Republicans have a history of having these bruising primaries where they compete to out MAGA each other before going into the general election and trying to win over moderate and Democratic voters throughout New York State. The other big thing that, other than the horse race to the governor's office or the governor's race, the other big thing that I thought coming out, Joe, which you mentioned, is the overwhelming support for universal child care in the state, which was Zohram Mamdani's big, you know, topic that he ran on. Free buses and overwhelming support to increase taxes on people making $1 million a year. That's something that the governor has resisted. The governor has indicated that in the coming budget season that she wants to potentially increase taxes on corporations. But having overwhelming support for increasing taxes on individuals is something that I would say may not been anticipated and could shape what we see in the upcoming legislative session and the budget making session in advance of the governor's reelection year here in 2026.
Oh, grizzled newspaper editor, what do you make of polls like this at this point in the race?
The first thing I thought when I looked at this was, well, now I'm not surprised that Elise Stefanik is spearheading an attack on Mike Johnson in the House. That, you know, and I think I'm not the first person to say this, that I think she knows this is an unwinnable race for her unless there is a major scandal that takes Kathy Hochul down. And Elise Stefanik is positioning herself to be the next Speaker of the House. And that would be her bail.
Yeah. Oh, grizzled retired editorial person.
From one to another, yeah. I, you know, you can play that game a year out and speculate on what if. I mean, what I wonder now is if the polls don't significantly improve for Elise Stefanik to be a competitor against incumbent Kathy Hochul, the Democrat, for governor next year, in less than a year now, I would be willing to bet that she may decide to retain her House seat, come up with some story, just as you're suggesting, mm-hmm. too. You know, I think that and it's funny, you know, JP, as you point out, the two candidates leading Republicans for the nomination for governor, Bruce Blakeman, was an old friend of President Trump's from back in the 80s when they were real estate guys in Manhattan, and they're good friends. And of course, Elise Stefanik has been a total mega supporter all through Trump's presidency and prior to that. And he has not endorsed in that primary, in what could be a primary in that race. And he may do something to give cover to Elise Stefanik to come back into the House. Yeah, well, she's not out of the House now, but I mean, come back into the race and stay as a Congress member. Because right now, it's a whole nother story, but it's a very complicated fight going on with Republicans on who is going to run in her place. And there's a lot of big money in it, and it could open a split in the Republican Party that might turn that seat to a Democrat.
I have little.
Uh-huh.
Stop. I have no sympathy for Elise Stefanik in this, but she did get screwed.
Yeah, she sure did.
Yeah, I mean
a couple of times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean just
between Trump and Johnson, they have not treated her well after her loyalty.
So the going after the leadership, the wanting another position. I mean, that all makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so to see if you can then come back, if this doesn't work out, that'll be interesting to see. But a lot can happen, can't it?
It can.
Boy, I wasn't a newspaper editor, but I was a yearbook editor in high school.
There
Does
you go.
That count?
Well,
well, that's way better.
Absolutely.
You're not old and grizzled, though.
obviously, that Hochul is in great shape as she heads into the real meat of the campaign year. And I think she's been very politically astute this year. She had a couple missteps last year, but not so many this year. And she's navigated this landscape. She's unlike Gavin Newsom, who has become sort of a lightning rod in positive and negative ways. I think she's positioned herself as protecting New York from Trump while not attracting the same kind of like national ire that Gavin Newsom has. And so it's been, I think, pretty smart of her.
I think to JP's point about the other things that the poll is showing, that is going to be a challenge for her to kind of navigate the wealth that she needs to pour into her campaign versus the very liberal streak in New Yorkers. I said that as fast as I could.
No, you did good. You did fine. Jay Jochtowitz, JP Miller, Mike Spain, Malia Dumont. Thank you all for being with us. A delight to have you and your perspectives on the program. I appreciate it. More than you'll know. I'm going to cough. There we go. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have the second half of, or no, the third hour. It's the finale of the big show right after this.